This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The NCAA basketball tournament, also known as March Madness, is starting. A Western Michigan University alumnus has examined one of the most successful coaches in college basketball history. John Matthew Smith is a history professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology. His book is called The Sons of Westwood, John Wooden, UCLA, and the Dynasty That Changed College Basketball. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What made you want to write a book about John Wooden?
That's a great question. Before I knew I wanted to write about John Wooden, I was really thinking about writing about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He was born Lewell Cinder. He was a Catholic before he converted to Islam. And what I was most interested in about the life of Lewell Cinder was how he developed this racial consciousness in the age of the Civil Rights Movement. Because not only was he the greatest celebrity college basketball player since Wilt Chamberlain, but he was very thoughtful. He was incredibly smart. And in an age when college athletes were told from coaches and other authority figures that you don't talk about social issues and political issues, Lewell Cinder was really at the forefront of a new voice in Black America, and that was on the college campus. He talked about racism and discrimination. He became involved in a movement to boycott the 1968 Olympics. Ultimately, didn't decide to actually boycott the Olympics with these other athletes, but he made a choice independently and said, I'm choosing not to play in the Olympics in 1968 in protest of racism in America. And so I was fascinated by this, by Elsinger's decision as the greatest, most dominant college basketball player in America, the consequences of making such a decision. There was a backlash against this choice. And so the more I studied Elsinger, the more I came around to thinking about Wooden and their relationship and how they were very different. You know, Wooden grows up in the 1920s in Indiana when the Ku Klux Klan dominated state politics, when the Klan had rallies in Wooden's hometown of Martinsville. And so I thought, here you have these two icons who represented very different things. Wooden was a conservative. Elsinder is someone who believes in the Black Power movement. And I thought that this was an opportunity to tell the story of the UCLA dynasty, not only how Wooden had built these great teams with Elsinder as a pivotal figure, but also to discuss the intersection between sports and racial politics through the lives of Elsinder and Wooden.
And of course, beyond Lew Elsinder, there's also Bill Walton, who comes into the mix a little bit later, who is very outspoken. He's a white player, but very outspoken with progressive views. And John Wooden, in many ways, kind of the embodiment of what we see as the button-down, conservative, authoritarian coach, had to deal with these personalities. Did that in some ways maybe make a good microcosm of what was going on in America in the 60s and 70s?
Exactly. There's this evolution that takes place. In the beginning of the movement of this athletic revolution, as it was called, which was a reference to the political activism of college athletes, it began really with Black players who were influenced by the Civil Rights Movement. But then as the Vietnam War escalated, and the counterculture emerged on America's campuses, you had more white athletes who began challenging authority, as you mentioned. And Bill Walton was the most visible example of this. When Walton came to UCLA, there was an expectation that, you know, he would be like all the other white athletes, that he would be a conservative force on campus in the sense that he was selfless on the basketball court. He didn't want too much attention. And in fact, he did not like doing interviews. He had a speech impediment. But gradually, as he became a star and reporters started to wanting to learn more about him, he revealed that he had very strong opinions about poverty and race in the Vietnam War. And ultimately, Walton is remembered in many ways not only for being a great basketball player at UCLA, a three-time All-American, but someone who was arrested for shutting down the administration building. And so this sent off all sorts of shockwaves in California and across America. How is it that this All-American basketball player could become arrested for shutting down the administration? And so, you know, there was tension between Wooden and Walton. You know, now Walton talks about Wooden in reverential terms and talks about how much he admired him, but Walton, more than anyone else, tested John Wooden in practice and off the court because of his social and political views. And they butted heads. And quite honestly, by the time Walton left UCLA, as much as Wooden enjoyed coaching Walton the player, he was ready for him to go.
Did John Wooden in some ways then maybe represent what a lot of American parents went through with their own children, watching them grow up, have different ideas about things like warfare and race and poverty, and having to maybe discuss some uncomfortable subjects that had not come up for those older people with their parents?
Absolutely. So what happens during the 1960s with the civil rights movement, the free speech movement on campus, and the peace movement is that young people see protest challenging authority as part of the natural experience of being young. That's what you did. It was normal. And I think the wider public respected Wooden because in the world of sports, he filled this cultural void of moral authority, right? In this age where young people are turning a deaf ear to their parents and their professors and administrators, here's Wooden who seems to find a way to get his players to listen to him, to respect his authority, the boundaries he creates for the team. But the fact is that behind the scenes, when the cameras were shut off and the reporters weren't watching, you know, his players did test him. They did challenge him. They had arguments not only about his rules and curfew, but about social issues and political issues. The 1970 national championship team wrote a protest letter to President Richard Nixon. And the fact is that Coach Wooden had instructed his players to avoid demonstrations. And he was convinced that politics and sports should not mix. You know, he was a guy who believed that civility triumphed demonstrations, that, you know, if you have a protest, if you have something to say, that it can be done in an orderly way. And so in many ways, he belonged to this conservative group in the late 60s and early 70s that was known as the silent majority. And that's what Richard Nixon called them, the great silent majority. It was the idea that the majority of Americans, people who are Wooden's age or, you know, held more conservative values, they believed in law and order, right? And so they believed that America should return to the order that existed before the race riots and the anti-war demonstrations and the free speech protests on campus. And so in many ways, I thought that this would be a book that would help us better understand that intersection between youthful protest and college sports, and to tell it in a way that hadn't been done before.
And speaking of things which happened away from the cameras and microphones and those sort of things, you tell us that NCAA rules were sometimes broken. There's a gentleman named Sam Gilbert who becomes a character in this book known as the Godfather. Who was he? What was the association with the UCLA?
Sure. Sam Gilbert had relationships with some basketball players for a long time. He was a fan, a man who had a big ego, and he liked having these friendships with the players. And for a while, I would say in the mid-60s, you know, he wasn't someone anyone at UCLA and UCLA Athletics had to worry about. But then in 1967, when Lou Alcindor and Lucius Allen are there, they're not entirely happy with their life at UCLA. And some people have said that perhaps there were promises that were made that weren't fulfilled. Others have said that perhaps Alcindor and Allen, who were both African-American, felt as if that the culture in California, Southern California, was not as liberal as they imagined, so they were dissatisfied. And so to make a long story short, a former UCLA player named Willie Knowles had a business relationship with Sam Gilbert, and Willie Knowles introduced Alcindor and Allen to Gilbert. And so gradually, Gilbert was able to help them, you know, lessen their concerns in some ways. And over time, what happened was that Gilbert believed that he had a greater importance in the program. And he helped the players get discounts for merchandise. He gave them loans. And eventually, he negotiated NBA contracts. Now, that is not illegal under the United States of America, but it's a violation of NCAA rules because players, college players who are amateurs, are not allowed to sign professional contracts with agents or professional contracts with teams. And Gilbert was representing them openly. I mean, the press, the Los Angeles Times, Time Magazine, they did stories on Sam Gilbert. This was out in the open. And anyone who knew about Sam Gilbert, who followed the program, or rival coaches who knew about Sam Gilbert, felt that UCLA openly violated rules. Now, the reality is that John Wooden and the athletic director, J.D. Morgan, they did confront Sam Gilbert. They did say, please, you know, be aware of what the rules are. You know, please keep your distance with the players. But the fact is that Gilbert also had some associations that intimidated J.D. Morgan, that he felt that if he pushed Gilbert too hard, he might retaliate in who knows what kind of way, shall we say. In the end, the NCAA investigated UCLA after John Wooden retired, and they did find that there were some improprieties, violations of rules, and eventually the NCAA did have some penalties put on the program, but that was in the early 1980s, so that was 5 years after Wooden had retired. But the fact is, if you interviewed the players, if you talked to the players, some of the most visible players in the program, they admitted that, yes, we received favors. We did violate the rules. But I do want to be clear that John Wooden never asked for Sam Gilbert's help. He never asked for any booster's help in recruiting a player. It was only after they arrived at UCLA that Gilbert developed these friendships with these guys who were very flattered, and they liked the fact that someone did these favors for them. So part of the legacy, though, I think, about the UCLA dynasty is that it helps us better understand the commercialization of the sport and how it was becoming professionalized and how these young players who went to UCLA to play for Wooden had aspirations of becoming a pro, and they had seen how Sam Gilbert and the players who had come before helped negotiate these contracts and made life easier for them and would listen to their problems in a way that Wooden wouldn't. Some of the players had said that they felt that they could go to Gilbert and talk about problems with a girlfriend or problems in class. They could open up to him in a way that wouldn't listen to, and that Wooden kept his distance, as sometimes coaches feel like they have to do.
John Wooden did complain often about the commercialization of college basketball during his time as coach at UCLA, and then for the many years that he was still alive after he retired. He lived to almost 100 years old. But how much did he contribute to the commercialization of college basketball with his incredible teams at UCLA, which were in demand, for instance, playing a marquee game in the Astrodome? How much does this add to what college basketball eventually has become?
It's critical. It's crucial. You know, the UCLA dynasty is at the center of the basketball revolution in America, the college basketball revolution, and that the sport becomes more commercialized and professionalized, and UCLA paves the way for that to happen. You mentioned the Astrodome game. J.D. Morgan, the athletic director, came to Wooden and said, look, University of Houston is interested in playing us in the Astrodome, this large domed arena. Now, to us today, that seems perfectly natural. That's where we play the Final Four. Yeah. So, but what we have to remember is this had never been done before. You know, the Astrodome at that time, it's a baseball stadium. It's for football. It's for the circus. It's for the rodeo. It's for Billy Graham crusades. There'd never been a basketball game there before. But Morgan explains to Wooden that if UCLA plays Houston there, we might be able to fill half the stadium, which would have been about 25,000 people. And that would have broken a record. And what that would have meant is it would have brought in revenues that would pay for the entire year, all of our athletic bills, all of the other minor sports, if you will. And Wooden, you know, he just didn't seem convinced. He said, you know, this is going to make a spectacle of college basketball. And J.D. Morgan's thought was, exactly. That's the whole point. So this game gets put on national television. It's the first regular season game that was put on national television live and in color. And it was broadcast over 150 channels. And 20 million people watched this game. They wanted to tune in to see UCLA lose. And ultimately, UCLA lost by 2 points. But really, the game's legacy, part of the legacy of the UCLA dynasty, is that that game proved there was a national audience for college basketball that the networks didn't think existed. And after that season, NBC paid more than double what the previous contract was for a sports television network for the rights to the Final Four. And increasingly over the course of the dynasty, the NCAA tournament expanded. You had more teams. When Wooden first won the national championship in 1964, there were 25 teams. When he retired in 1975, there were 32 teams. And the tournament continued to grow afterwards. The dollars that the networks offered to broadcast the games continued to grow as well. So one of the things I often say is that if you want to understand the origins of March Madness, you have to know that it started back in January 1968 in the Houston Astrodome.
Something else that John Wooden often said he did not like about college basketball was recruiting. And early on in his career, he really didn't do a lot of recruiting. And now, of course, there are websites which are dedicated to which player is going where and rating players on a star system and all these other things. But it was also pointed out by one of his assistants that during his first 15 years at UCLA, John Wooden did not win any championships. And it was after he went out and recruited players from outside the state
that the talent got better. How much, when we talk about that pyramid of success that John Wooden would talk about, how much of that pyramid has a foundation of very talented basketball players being convinced to play at UCLA?
Wooden was a great practice coach. He was excellent at teaching the fundamentals, getting different guys to play well together, to be selfless. No question about that. But no coach is successful without talent. And most of them will tell you that, if they can put their ego aside. And Wooden would say so. One of the things that he said, I think it was in 1968, is that the Bruins' success really depended in large part on the fact that they had integrated teams. They brought in black players. And the biggest stars who were black came from outside of California. Walt Hazard, who was an All-American on the first national championship team, was from Philadelphia. Lew Alcindor, or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, was from New York. And this changed things, you know, that UCLA would recruit nationally now, or that it now had a national profile because the press in Philadelphia followed Hazard's success. The press in New York City and everywhere else followed Lew Alcindor's success. UCLA creates a national storyline. They are the national storyline. Every major newspaper in the country is following what is happening at UCLA. And so in some ways, Wooden didn't really have to try that hard to continue to recruit out of state. You know, his success created more success, the demand for the best players across the country to come to UCLA. But he hated the process of recruiting. He let his assistants do it. Because the fact is, he felt that recruiting, being a recruiter, was like being a salesman. And John Wooden wasn't a salesman. You know, he saw himself as a teacher. He felt that if players wanted to come to UCLA, if they were interested in the program, they could write him a letter, he'd write them back, and they could come visit the campus, and he would talk to them. And that was the extent of what he wanted to do in terms of recruiting. But over the course of the 1970s, the role of the coach changes. Other coaches are responding to Wooden's success. They realize that if you're going to be successful, if you're in California, if you're USC or Cal Berkeley, maybe you too need to recruit in New York. And so it changes the role of the coach. And so, again, Wooden's success led other coaches to make decisions about the kinds of players they brought into their programs, where they recruited, and how they looked at their recruiting network, not just in their region of the country, but the entire country.
And as we note, that success is an amazing record, especially over those 12 years where they won 10 NCAA championships. There's an 88-game winning streak in there, seven consecutive national championships. Is it possible, with the changes which have come to college basketball, that anyone could do that again or even come close to something like that?
I often tell students that as a historian, I'm very bad at predicting the future. I'm much better at telling you about the past. But I can say confidently it will never happen again. And I think it's because of the structure of the sport today is far different than it was when Wooden was coaching. As we talked about off air, you have to win more games now to win one national championship. In Wooden's era, his first title, they had a bye, and then they had to win four games to win it all. But gradually, as the tournament expanded, you have to win more games. The other challenge that coaches face today is their very best players who have a chance to play professionally leave earlier. So you don't have teams that are together for a long period of time where they can develop cohesion. Your best stars leave, so you know then you have to recruit again. So you spend more energy actually recruiting, trying to get guys to come to your program. And that's not something Wooden had to do. All of his best players, even Walton and Lew Alcindor, they stayed for 4 years. And so that was part of his success as well, is that he had the continuity with his players. And he could build around them. He knew what it is that he had. You know, coaches like John Calipari or Tom Izzo or Mike Krzyzewski, they may have players who they know are going to the NBA, but maybe they're not sure if they're going to go after their freshman year or their sophomore year, but they know they're not coming back after their sophomore year. And that makes it far more challenging to build a dynasty. There are no dynasties in college basketball today, and I don't imagine there ever will be again.
Since John Wooden retired from UCLA, there have been many head coaches there who have tried to follow in his footsteps, including Larry Farmer, who's currently an assistant at Western Michigan University. Jim Herrick did win a national title in the mid-90s, but there has not been the sustained success that Wooden had. Does his shadow loom over the program, and did he just create expectations which no mortal can match in today's college basketball world?
Yeah, I think in some ways his shadow does still linger. Though gradually, I think as time passes, the shadow diminishes. I think the expectations, given the failures of some pretty good coaches, I think it was Ben Howland who had gone there. He's, in my view, a really good coach, but the pressures eventually forced him out because the expectations were so high when he had taken them, I think, to two back-to-back Final Fours. At any rate, I'm not sure. You know, is it possible that Steve Alford will be the guy that leads UCLA back to the promised land? Maybe. But I think the fact is that UCLA is no longer a destination for the best recruits. The competition, the landscape in college basketball, we've seen in the past few years that mid-majors can have success, you can have programs that can challenge the powerhouses. Even at Duke, Coach K, you know, he's had success. He's won, I think, four national championships, but never a stretch run where he's dominated the sport at any one time. He did win his first two. I think they were back-to-back. But outside of him, it just doesn't happen anymore. And I think the reality is that college basketball's the competition of the sport is far more even today than it was when Wooden was coaching. That year in, year out, some of the best teams were always showing up in the Sweet 16 or the Elite Eight, where now we have our Cinderella stories, and oftentimes they come from programs that we don't expect to make a run. You know, we think of the success that Butler had, for example, a stretch run there. Before that, yeah, people thought, oh, they're a nice story, but, you know, they were more than a nice story. But will they continue to have success now that they, you know, their coach has left for the NBA to play a coach for the Celtics? Probably not. So even the relationships the coaches have with the programs, the coaches themselves don't always stay for very long. It remains to be seen how long Steve Alford will get to stay. So at any rate, you know, there's a lot of complications and factors, I think, that have changed since then that make it very difficult for any coach to have an enduring legacy of success.
I'm going to wrap up our interview by using the beginning of your book, where you tell us that as John Wooden was nearing his death at almost 100 years of age, that the players whom he had coached were all kind of trying to get to Los Angeles to say goodbye, including Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who we started this conversation off with, who certainly had a different worldview than John Wooden, and these two gentlemen came together in an interesting way. But is that his legacy, that a lot of these players whom he did have conflict with and he butted heads with, at the end of the day, they appreciated what he had taught them as basketball players and as men?
Very much so. It's interesting. I just came from lunch, and Coach Farmer was at lunch with me. And
Who played for
John Wooden, yes. And the fact is, a lot of the guys that I talked to are just reading more recent stories where they were interviewed by journalists. They all said to a man that, you know, when we played for him, he was tough as nails. And sometimes they dreaded going into his office and hearing his lectures and, you know, being reminded about the rules and how they're supposed to behave and, you know, stay in class and all those kinds of things. But after they graduated and they reflected on the lessons that Wooden tried to teach them when they were young men in their late teens and 20s, you know, they absorbed those things. They could still hear his voice in their head saying things like, be quick, but don't hurry, right? These things that would stick with them. And they would go back and they would visit Coach, and they had they developed a relationship as adults that was different from the one that they developed with him when they came in as, you know, adolescents, essentially. And so many of them talk about how proud they were that they became friends. But you couldn't be Coach Wooden's friend when you were his player, but you could develop a friendship, a bond, an intimacy as you grew up, as you became a father and you had responsibilities. And now you kind of understood what Coach Wooden was saying when you were 18, 19 years old. And that seemed to be the pattern, that when guys left, when they went away for years and came back, they had more in common with him now because they had responsibilities. They understood what it is he was trying to teach them throughout their time at UCLA.
John Matthew Smith, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
John Matthew Smith is the author of the book, The Sons of Westwood, John Wooden, UCLA, and the Dynasty That Changed College Basketball. John Matthew Smith is a Western Michigan University alumnus and now a history professor at Georgia Tech.